Today's lecture is show and tell. I want to introduce a few interesting Julia packages to you. And of course, I'm not going to give you an in-depth introduction. If you want to know more about a well-known Julia package, there's probably a talk someone gave on YouTube. And if there's no talk, that probably means there's no conference paper on it, then maybe the package isn't that interesting. Anyway, I'm just going to show you the packages and we're going to experiment one. The first package I want to introduce, because I think it's really cool, it's called a package called AproxFun. I don't know whether you can read this here. Is this large enough? Very good. AproxFun is a package to approximate functions. And the first, whenever someone suggests a package to me, I go to the GitHub repository where the package is located and look at a few statistics. So here, for example, you see that 31 people forked the package. That's a reasonable number of people. There are about 4,000 commits to the package, so it sees development. There are 26 contributors, so it's not just the one person effort. So this seems to be a well-maintained and active package. If you scroll down a bit, you see all these nice badges here. There's documentations. Documentation is checked. The build is actually passing. Code coverage is 90%, is good. Chat on Gitter. If I click on that one, probably a chat window will open where I can contact some of the developers. So all these are actually good signs for a package that has some community. But now to what the package actually does. This package is about approximating functions. This is functions that are smooth. They have derivatives, probably analytic functions. And this package is actually based on journal publications by a British math professor. And the basic idea is that expand everything into Chebyshev polynomials and generalizations thereof. And these packages has really nice features. So now let me use this package from a Julia window. So I'm going to switch over to a shell. Is that large enough? Can you read the text? No one complains. I'm going to create a directory. Memcached what showcases cd into showcases, start my Julia thing, activate the current package, and now I add AproxFun. I have to wait a bit, of course. Does its thing. And then I'm going to actually use some of these examples here, and then we see at the look at the output and see what happens here. Using. Okay, I need to add more packages, special functions. Let's hope that that works. Probably need plots as well. Using. It's doing its recompiling thing. Yeah, sometimes that's inconvenient. But I did want to show you actually everything, including how you get to a package. But the AproxFun is a package that's registered with the Julia packages. So you just type add AproxFun and Julia knows what to do. If you write your own package, it's probably not registered, then it's more difficult to get a package. And I have one example of such a package later on as well. Okay, the recompiling takes a bit longer. Let me explain what the package does. You can approximate functions via Chebyshev polynomials. So what this package does, if you have a generic functions, it expands the function into Chebyshev polynomials and it intelligently chooses all the parameters for that. For example, if you have an analytic function, you expect that the expansion coefficients at some point drop off exponentially. The package looks for that. It finds out when the coefficients have become so small that they're not relevant anymore. It introduces a cutoff there. That is, it chooses automatically how many coefficients are necessary to get the full floating point. It's still compiling, right? To get the full floating point accuracy. Apologies, it should get started in a minute. Okay, I tried this at home yesterday, actually at work yesterday, and it was working faster. I don't know why it's so slow today. Maybe the Solstice client is using up some CPU. I don't know. Okay, let's give it 10 more seconds, and then I'll walk you through the example by hand instead, if it doesn't finish far enough. So after you expanded a function in Chebyshev polynomials, have the coefficients, of course, you can evaluate the function everywhere. That is nice, but that's not the interesting thing. You can also do the usual operations with functions. You can multiply by 2, take a square. You can compose functions f of g of x, and so on. And of course, you can also do things like calculate derivatives. you can find zeros, the roots of a polynomial. And for polynomials, you have the fundamental theorem of algebra. You know exactly how many roots there should be and where they are. And root finding these days, you can do that to arbitrary accuracy. So if you have a function expanded, you can easily find all the roots. And you don't need to guess, oh, there might be a root there or there might not be a root there. This package has functions to give you all the roots. And then you know these are the roots. And similar maxima, minima, of course, just the roots of the derivative and so on. I need to do more talking here. Okay. Well, since you have expanded the functions in terms of a basis, you can also solve differential equations with that package. Taking a derivative operator, once you have chosen a particular basis, that operator has a matrix representation, so it's just a large matrix for the derivative operator. And then solving a PDE, a linear PDE, is just solving a linear system of equations. And this has quite nice features for solving PDEs, not just linear, but also nonlinear ones. And unfortunately, it uses some clever tricks that, as far as I know, have only worked out in 2D. So you can't do it in higher dimensions. I mean, I would love to solve the Einstein equations with something like that. But it works only in 2D. That's another example I wanted to give. It's 7 minutes into the lecture, and that thing is still recompiling. Okay. Into block arrays. I don't know. I think the function base.indices might have been renamed to something else in Julia 1.0 or does something else. I'm sure the simple examples I want to show you work anyway. Okay, let's give it a few more seconds and then I really need to think of a plan B here.
May I ask a question?
Oh, please, yes, thank you.
If you do everything in the package, there is a package console, right?
Yes.
You can do add plots, add special functions.
Yes.
But if I want to develop my project.
Yes.
So how can I do this?
So one way to do that is you have a directory and you generate a package. And as we did before, thank you, yes. Yes. And this is then a package that you have. But you can also take an existing package and continue to develop it. And there is a particular command in the package manager. It might even be develop or something. And what it then does, it checks out from GitHub a particular version of the package, probably the most recent version, not the most recent release, the master. And then
in the reality, how can I write in the code?
Oh. If you write this develop thing, it checks out a particular version and you can find out where it has been checked out in your file system. And then you need to open an editor, such as we did, and change the code. And then you can run the test cases and so on. And at some point you use Git to make a commit and then push the changes back upstream or back into your repository. Okay. Next lecture on Friday, I can show you how to do that. I think I should, please remind me if I forget. I'm getting stressed out by the lecture here. Very good. So we have this using statement. Now, we are choosing a particular coordinate. This is x is just the identity function from 0 to 10. We are taking a function f equals sine of x squared. And this here means okay, yeah, now let me wait until it's actually finished. Why does this take so long? This is incredible. I wanted to show you how snappy the package is. Like you just write sine of x squared and it gives you the coefficients. Okay, now you have a Chebyshev expansion of this function, sine of x squared is analytic and everything. And it gives, and the function lives on the interval 0 to 10. That's the interval we chose up here. And these are the expansion coefficients. These are not all the expansion coefficients. You see the triple dots here. That means it left out some of the expansion coefficients. And the first few coefficients, well, they are whatever they are. And the last coefficients are 10 to the minus 19. Apparently, that's the accuracy cutoff where the package decided you don't need any more. Let's look. What is it? Length of f? No. F dot coefs. Coefficients and length. Length of the coefficients array. So the package shows that you need 130 coefficients to have an accurate representation. And then, of course, you can write f of 0.4 And you can also write minus sine of 0.4 squared. And the result is 10 to the minus 16 floating point round off. So this is now an accurate representation. It uses 130 coefficients, but who cares? That is not a large number. You can choose another function, g equals cosine of x, and then you can continue. F plus c squared, and that is another thing. Now we can look how many coefficients h has. Still 130, okay. We look at the roots of h, and since it's a polynomial, there you go, 32 roots, and these are the locations of the roots. And we can also look at the roots of the derivatives of h. H prime is the derivative. Apparently there are 34 maxima and minima of h, roots of the derivative. The polynomial doesn't have more roots. It should. Why should it have an infinite number of roots? It's an analytic function. Okay, am I not seeing something here? Is it because the range is 0 to 10? Yes. You think something special happens near 0? Maybe I should have used a different example or so. Okay. So this is the function that is plotted here. I'm looking at the web browser now and how it looks like. An interval from 0 to 10. Apparently, the red points are the root. There are apparently only a finite number of roots. Now, we chose a particular interval, which is a function space 0 to 10. And there, the function has indeed only a finite number of roots. This comes because we express things in terms of Chebyshev polynomials. You can take derivatives and so on. I wanted to show you something else. F equals sine of x squared. We can take 100x squared. And then you have 6,000 coefficients. We can take 8,000 x squared. Now 8,000 x squared oscillates quite rapidly, so you need many coefficients to represent it. Now we need 500,000 coefficients to represent that function. You know that my laptop actually hesitated for a second. I'm kind of mad about that because it's not supposed to do that. And it definitely doesn't do that if I'm not in a lecture. Anyway, anyway, a system like that on a computer, you can easily handle a million coefficients, right? That a million coefficients should take no more milliseconds to handle. So with all the complicated operations, it should take seconds. You can do quite complicated things. Derivatives, something else I wanted to show. Solving ODEs is interesting, but I want to solve PDEs. Here, PDEs, let me do this. This is the same package. So first we set D to the unit interval, that's the interval from minus 1 to 1, squared, the squaring an interval, the operator is overloaded, as meaning a tensor product. So now we have a product domain, and yada, 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 yada. Unit interval that is minus 1 to 1 and minus 1 to 1, so it's a two-dimensional interval. Then we get the Laplacian of that domain, assign it to the variable delta. It's not doing anything right now, no calculation, it just... Okay, well, it already did output what I wanted to say. By default, the interval, the basis the package shows for the interval is Chebyshev functions. And if you take a derivative of a Chebyshev function and look at the respective matrix, you find that it's dense. It calculated the matrix representation. Okay, very good, yes. It is dense, but there's a really clever trick, and that is at the heart of the package. If you calculate the derivative of a Chebyshev polynomial and perform a basis transformation to go from Chebyshev polynomials to ultraspherical polynomials, then the derivative matrix looks much easier. That is, you get the derivative of in a different basis. Ultraspherical polynomials of degree 0 are Chebyshev polynomials. If you go to degree 1, it looks much simpler. And this is what happens here. So the new basis is ultraspherical polynomials of degree 2. Right, Laplacian, second derivative. And then the respective operator looks very simple. You might not see it. It's difficult to see what zeros and non-zeros are. And then you can actually solve partial differential equations. So let's choose some boundary conditions. It uses this nice notation where it takes this partial operator to mean the boundary of domain D. That's not the boundary that goes across that unit interval. And ones is the function that's all one everywhere. Then you have this, and then you can solve the respective PDE. So yeah, it uses this backslash division operator where you divide a matrix by a vector or a vector by a matrix to mean invert the matrix, solve the linear system. This is the actual operator. First is the boundary conditions. Can I actually see that in the back? No, what is in compiling? It means Dirichlet boundary conditions on the domain B, domain D. And the second argument to the function here is this array. The Dirichlet values are F. Then you have the actual operator, that a plus operator, plus 100 times the identity matrix. That means it's the Helmholtz equation that you solve. And the right-hand side for that is zero. It solves it with a particular tolerance. And then you get the respective solution. Did I hit enter? Yes. And that, of course, will not take 5 minutes as well. Really, it's supposed to be really snappy. And it just solves that and gives you a numerical solution. The whole domain nicely represented in terms of Chebyshevs and everything up to the particular tolerance. Usually, you would not specify tolerance, and the package would go up to 10 to the minus 15. Apparently, the PDE with these boundary conditions has some kind of singularity in the corners, so you need to specify tolerance. Otherwise, it's not well posed, the problem. And let's see how many coefficients are there. 1,000 coefficients in the end, and it all happens quite nicely. And I could plot it, but let's see what happens if I plot it. Most likely it's going to recompile something and it's going to take an eternity. Yeah, I think my laptop is not feeling well today. Okay, sorry. There's an error message. I don't know what it is. No method matching closed candidates are. Okay, I assume that surface plots worked in Julia 0.7 and haven't been updated yet for version 1.0. So if I get time, or if you have time now, you can submit a bug report to the package and hope that they'll fix it. Not that they'll probably be happy about that, right? I mean, that's an example that I'd be happy to know that something doesn't work anymore. Okay. That was this package. It's a really neat and easy way to solve partial differential equations and to represent functions in one and two dimensions. This method has unfortunately not been generalized to higher dimensions, although I think it should be. But if you look at the respective paper upon which the package is built, that hasn't been done yet. Let's move on to another package. Yes? Good question. I actually only realized while speaking here that this is a linear equation. I don't know where that has been. It might be. And there are also add-on packages to use Fourier polynomials or spherical harmonics and so on. You don't have to use Chebyshev polynomials there. Okay. Another way, another interesting package is about taking derivatives. Taking derivatives is really important in linear algebra and in computer algebra, obviously. If you have a partial differential equation, obviously it's important, but also you have an optimization problem. You usually take a derivative because to optimize a function, if the function is smooth, has derivatives, you take a derivative and look for zeros there. This package is known, thank you, called forward diff. And there's this convention that Julia packages always end in .jl. That makes it really easy to Google for a Julia package. Because if you Google for forward diff.jl, it's going to find that. You don't have to type GitHub or Julia or anything to it. And when you calculate derivatives automatically, there are two different ways called forward differentiation and backward differentiation. On forward differentiation means as you evaluate a function, you evaluate the respective derivative of the function at the same time. That's an efficient way of evaluating derivatives. Okay, you see 600 commits, 33 contributors, 41 releases, still a reasonable packages. All the badges are green, still a good thing. And we can look at an example here. So if this compiling takes much longer, then I'm just going to point to the examples on the website. Sorry about that, I didn't expect that. Let me check, maybe there's a process running that takes a lot of CPU time. No, it's just the Solstice client that I'm having here. And the idea is whenever you evaluate a function, for example, sine of square root of x or something, then first you have x, then you say take the square root of x, you evaluate the square root and the derivative of the square root, then you take the sine of that, you take evaluate the sine and the derivative cosine, and so on. So you, as you evaluate, you keep kind of track of the function and its derivative. And the real neat trick of doing so is to use dual numbers. I don't know whether you're familiar with that. You're probably familiar with complex numbers, where you have an additional number, I, imaginary unit, that's not a real number, and every complex number then has two parts, real and imaginary part, and the rule is I squared is minus one. A dual number was invented at, I guess, approximately the same time. I don't know who, maybe Grassmann or so. And the idea is that each number has a number and the respective dual part. The symbol you use for that is usually epsilon, and the rule is epsilon squared is zero. So you have an epsilon, which is not a real number, and its square, it's zero. It's totally familiar to any physicist, obviously. And you can use dual numbers to represent functions and its derivative. If you put things into a dual number, you see that the dual part is just the respective derivative of a function. So if you evaluate a function, say you write the function, say it takes a double precision argument, then you get result. If you change the function type to be a dual number with double precision components, then you get the function and its derivative. And one of the key ingredients that makes it work in Julia is, of course, that you write parametric functions. If you write your own function to say the argument must always be float 64, then you can't apply that. But if you say, well, the argument is some type t, I don't care what t is, then you can do this trick of substituting float 64 with a dual number of float 64, and then this works, and it is very efficient. And here we have a function that, of course, the argument to a function can't just be number, it can also be a vector or something, not just a scalar. So we have, can't define function, let's call it f2. Yeah, I should have started a new notebook. So this function f2 depends on a vector of inputs, several inputs. This function here, sum of sine of x, takes that vector, applies the sine function to every element, and then sums all the elements together. Product of tangent of x, the same thing. Sum of square root of x, same thing. So the result of f2 is a scalar. So f2 maps a vector to a scalar. And then let's choose some particular x. Apparently the example suggests use a random number with 5 elements. And then let's calculate the gradient of f. Okay, g of x. That can't be. Why is that mismatch sizes? Thank you. F2. Yeah, I wanted to write FF in the beginning. Oof, okay, very good. Very good. So this is now the gradient of F. And since F maps a vector to a scalar, the gradient is not actually a matrix, it's just the vector as well. Apparently we can also look at the Hessian. I've never did that before. Let's see whether it works. Let's call it G2, just to make it interesting. Yes, thank you. I need to write F2 again. Something's not right with me today. And this is now the respective matrix. And that is very convenient. I mentioned earlier, if you want to optimize a function that is smooth and has derivatives, you usually take a derivative of the function and look for zeros of the derivative. Now, I don't know, I mean, you can think of minimizing an energy or having a Lagrangian or something. And if you have to take that derivative manually, that's very tedious and error prone. I mean, you can ask Mathematica and so on and then copy the Mathematica code or the Maple code into Julia and so on, but it's much more convenient to be able to just define the function in Julia and be able to take derivatives of that function. Yes, apparently there's a publication for that, and there are probably also, that's always a good sign, right? If the package and scientists actually write about it, that means the package has hand and foot. Now this is forward differentiation using dual numbers. There's also a reverse differentiation, obviously. There's forward, there's reverse. And this just does it the other way around. If you have sine of square root of x, then the evaluation order that you have is from the inside out, right? Ax square root sine. And the reverse differentiation actually starts by taking the derivative at the outside, as you would do in symbolic, if you take a derivative symbolically. First, you turn the sine into the cosine, and then chain rule, you look at the interior, which is then a square root, 1/2 square root, and so on. And a priori, it just, you might wonder why that is a good idea. And as an example of what the big difference between these can be, I mean, in terms of, it's a performance difference, I want to look at matrix multiplication. Let's assume you have a vector with 100 elements, and then you multiply twice with a matrix, with a square matrix, then you have A times B times F. Let me actually write that down. Something like A times B times a vector X. Then, of course, matrix vector multiplication is associative. So you have two choices. You can either evaluate this A times B times X, or as A times B times X. And if you multiply a matrix by a vector, the cost is n squared, 2n squared, actually. And if you multiply two matrices, the cost is n cubed, 2n cubed, actually. So the cost of the first option here is first 2n cubed for the A times B, and then plus 2n squared. And the cost of the bottom here is matrix vector, that's 2n squared, and another matrix vector, 2n squared. So one of these is 100 times more expensive than the other one. This is for a vector size of 100. If you think of machine learning or something where you have input some kind of image with 10,000 pixels, then your vector size is 10,000, then you immediately see that this is really, really important to choose the right order of taking of matrix vector multiplication. And actually, when you take derivatives, applying a derivative to a function I mentioned earlier that also has to do with linear operations, you see that there are similar cases where one of these could be much more efficient. So you have a package forward differentiation, reverse differentiation, that gives you only two options. If you have a more complicated function, the actually most efficient way is something in between. And I think the reverse differentiation module package is not really maintained anymore, and then people working on something more clever with respect to forward differentiation. But yeah, why use reverse diff, right? Very good, very good. Yes, so if you have a function that maps a vector to a scalar, then I believe you, I don't recall what you want, but it's clear that because the input is a vector and the output is a scalar, one of them, one of these directions is vastly more efficient. Yes, I'm not going to look at the examples here because taking a derivative, that you have seen that before. Now I want to use at the look at the package that comes out of a very different corner. This is a package that I heard about at JuliaCon in August. It's called Rewrite. And if we add the Rewrite package, then this happens, but nothing happens. You see an error message? Thank you, because the Rewrite package has not been registered yet. And if you publish your own package on GitHub, obviously it's not registered yet. So you can still add the package, but you need to add it by giving the URL to the respective GitHub repository. It's also possible. Now, apart from that, this package has one branch, three contributors, 170 commits. Clearly, it's a much smaller effort. There's not much going on, zero releases, but it has these green badges here, so that looks kind of okay. And what the Rewrite package implements is symbolic manipulation. It's any kind of algebra that you want built into Julia. I mentioned that in one of the previous lectures, that Julia is built on this Lisp-like syntax, has abstract syntax tree below, and you could, in principle, have Mathematica's operations in Julia, but much of the supporting infrastructure is not there, meaning it doesn't look elegant, and the tools are not yet supported. And this is now an effort by two people to provide some of the infrastructure. It does not look as elegant as Mathematica, but you can do things. I'm not going to show to actually type that in, but you can define particular symbols, x, y, b, and theta. You can normalize something. The result then looks like that. And that already looks a bit too ugly for me because the input is 1/sine, and then it writes division operator, and then the two arguments are this one, and this is the other argument, so it does not choose infix syntax. It makes it very difficult to read. So this just means the package is still immature, right? Fixing the output of that package wouldn't be difficult, but it hasn't been done yet. And what you can do here is you can define your own algebra. You can define what addition means, what multiplication means, whether it commutes, whether it associates, the particular rules that you have, and then it will apply these things, and the function normalize will then normalize the expression to, I don't know what normal form. That's similar to what Mathematica would do when you type simplify, when it applies distributivity and so on. And yeah, so you can do these things in Juilliard, but it doesn't look as elegant as in Mathematica. But who knows, maybe this package takes off, or maybe it was just a single presentation that two people gave. They're going to use it for one PhD thesis, and the package sinks back into nothingness, might also be. Juilliard has support for graphs as well. There's a package for representing graphs. There's a whole Juilliard community. Oh, I haven't told you about Juilliard communities. There are many Juilliard communities. There are communities for plotting, for machine learning, for graphs, for partial differential equations, for algebra, this and that, and so on. And there's a community for graphs as well. I'm going to highlight one particular package called Light Graphs. Light because it's kind of the lightweight interface. I don't think that any kind of graph that you might want can be represented with that package, but most kinds, and the probably presumably easier to use. So you can have directed graphs or undirected graphs. You can add weight to the nodes. You can add tags to the, weight to the edges and so on and so forth. You can many different things. And then you want to apply particular algorithms. And the question is what the package supports. So also, everything green except Juilliard version 0.6. Apparently something's not working with the package there. And there is this LightPath graphs package comes with a nice package called GraphPlot that plots graphs that looks very nice. Let me look at the tutorial to show you how it looks. There's tutorial, basic usage. Or rather, I want to say how it should look. So you define some graph. This is too small again. This is how you define a graph. You generate a graph with three vertices, and then you add edges to it. And then you plot it, and then something like this comes out. There are other graphs that can also be nicely plotted. Let's look down here, graphs like this. And it plots them automatically nicely. Really nice. Unfortunately, the package GraphPlot does not work with Juilliard 1.0. So this is a nice package in principle, but since I can't actually show the plotting, I thought maybe I want to move on to another package. But who knows, in 2 weeks or a month, this might actually work. And if you're doing something with graphs, social networks or other things, and it might be nice to use a package like that. Or I also don't know, maybe the development version of GraphPlot already works. It's just the current released version doesn't work yet. There's Juilliard Plots. That's the Juilliard community for plotting. Going to discuss that on Friday. So I'm going to skip it here. But there are obviously many utilities for plotting. Switching tag a bit, I want to now talk about benchmarking. If you write a Juilliard code, at some point you will get into the, you'll arrive at the problem that your code doesn't run fast enough, and you want to know what is wrong. Most of the time, it's some small oversight here and there, and the Juilliard manual actually describes what to do, how to look at the performance of the code. And since I haven't actually studied the Juilliard manual here in the lecture yet, let's do that now. Go to the documentation. It doesn't remember that I wanted larger. And let's type in performance up here. See what happens. This is not very useful. Okay. Profile here, profiling, a section on profiling. Profiling means you have your code and the code is working and the code is correct. And you choose a particular test problem, and you want to find out what about this test problem takes a long time and what is efficient. And that operation is called profiling. So you let Juilliard run on that test problem, and while it's running, the profiler inspects how Juilliard is executing it and then tells you what is fast and what is slow. And that is built into the language. It's a fundamental tool that you need everywhere because it might be something rather unnecessary that you do. For example, you might be constructing a 100 by 100 matrix every time in a loop iteration instead of doing it once during startup, and that then eats up 99% of your runtime, right? It could be something like that. And without profiling, you wouldn't know what this is the case. So let's look at some profiling. Let's look at some example. We should have a function. Oof. I now need to come up with the function of what we want to do. Good. Let's define a matrix. That's a 100 by 100 matrix. And the second one, B. And then we can multiply I and B, A and B. We don't need the output. And then we can check how long it takes to do that. There, what is that? There's a command for timing something. What is it? Is it at time? Do you remember? Yes. Okay, that was too small. So we need larger matrices here. Let's take 1,000 by 1,000. Come on. Hello. Oh, the editor did something here. So I want to multiply two matrices and see how long it takes. Two random matrices, and then multiply them. Okay, it takes the 35 milliseconds or something. If I do it again, yeah, still about that. So you can profile what takes how long. Actually, I'm afraid this will be a trivial function because matrix multiplication is probably built into the language. So you say using profile, that loads the module that defines all the profiling functions. And then you say profile.add profile. I don't think you need that. A times B. And then profile print outputs the profile. That's it. And this are all the functions that were recently executed, including how often the respective lines in the code, these are all individual lines in the code, how often they were executed. Now, if I multiply 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, there is one line that was executed 1 billion times. Unfortunately, that is hidden in deep into a system library, so you can't see it here. So I profiled something where Julia actually doesn't do any work. It just passes it on to some system library. That was pretty boring. I need to come up with another example. Can someone help me out? Function that does something interesting? Yeah, okay, let the function q of x comma y, r equals similar x for I in one length r, r I equals xi plus yi, 2 times xi plus yi, and r and function. You all know what this function does? It takes two inputs, x and y, presumably some kind of arrays. It allocates another array r that has the same shape and the same properties as the input x, just making something up here, and then a loop over every element of r, which so far is undefined, and perform some arithmetic operations, 2 times xi plus yi, and return r. And then I can q on a and b. Let's see what happens here. Sorry, I want to run it without looking at the output because the output is too large. Okay. I need larger matrices here. So 10,000 by 10,000. And b as well. Adding is faster than multiplying, so I need to increase the size of the matrices. And I time the result. Good, 1.13 seconds. And profile clear. I want to delete the currently stored profile information. And then I profile, not A times B, but Q applied to A and B. That took 1.3 seconds. And let's look at the profile, and then you see what took how much time. Okay, I said earlier, these numbers indicate how often a particular line was executed. That's not true. Profiling works differently. Every millisecond or something, the profiler stops Julia and looks which line is currently executing, puts that into a data structure, and continues to run the Julia code. And since this happens every millisecond or something, it does not actually introduce much overhead because Julia does 1 million operations per millisecond or something. But you still get, if the program runs for many milliseconds, you get a pretty good overview over where the code spends its time. And apparently, there is, what does here? So everything that has something to do with REPL has something to do with me calling the function actually on the command line. That's not interesting. But you see, so this, for example, is where I called the function q from the command line. So this is kind of the outermost part that interests me. This up here is what happens before the function q actually got called in the REPL, so this is also not interesting, but these things down here, these are the interesting pieces, and you see the slowest part here that was hit 438 times is the function setIndex. If you're familiar with Julia implements arrays, these square bracket operations are internally translated to function call. If you access an array on the right-hand side somewhere, it's translated into a call to getIndex. And if you assign something to an array element, that's called setIndex. So for some reason, setIndex was the slow part. And adding the two numbers that, I don't know, was hit 35 times, there's the multiplication, and there's something about promotion as well. Why promotion, can you guess? And Julia has a thing called type promotion, where one type is promoted to some other type. In this case, I type 2 times x. 2 needs to be promoted from integer to floating point type. And apparently that respective function was also hit 8 times. Now that type promotion actually doesn't cost any time. There's no machine instruction corresponding to it. That all happens at compile time. But it still shows up here. But you see the actual multiplication was hit 8 times. And the promotion that includes the multiplication was also hit 8 times. These numbers are cumulative, which explains why this is there. But that means that promotion itself took kind of a time of 0, if you so want. So apparently setIndex is more expensive than getIndex, although we call getIndex twice as often because we need to get x and y. And the reason is probably, I'm just guessing here, that we're allocating a rather large array. And if you allocate a large array, then the memory allocation on a modern operating system is actually delayed and doesn't actually happen until you access the array elements. So this is what happens here. The first time you access the array elements of R, the operating system needs to provide the memory for R. If you have a small array of, I don't know, 100 kilobytes or so, that wouldn't be the case. But we had something like, was it 10,000 by 10,000? That's 800 megabytes or something. And that actually is probably the operating system cost of just providing the array. So to optimize that function, and this is a guess that I had, we can pass in R already pre-allocated. We kind of reuse R every time the same R we call Q, and then that would be faster. I'm not going to try that here. And of course, figuring this out requires a bit of in-depth knowledge. Actually, this is profiling, and there's a whole chapter about that. Apparently, the section here is just a description of the actually functions. That's not the interesting part. I wanted to find the actual explanation. Yeah, performance tips, that's the section I was looking for. And these are tips in Julia, how to improve performance. First, things to do, what to avoid, measure performance, pay attention to memory allocation. What did it here? Yeah, so we had 6 allocations. We allocated 800 megabytes. Ah, there you go. My guess was correct. And the code spent 50% of its time in garbage collection. So garbage collection is when things get freed again. So we spent quite a bit of time allocating memory and freeing memory. And if you want to improve the performance, you just make sure that happens outside the loop, not inside. How does this section continue? Tools. And there, profiling, that is a tool that I actually briefly showed today. So if your code runs slowly, and that might happen, what most people do is they say, I know what is slow. I'm going to change that to make it faster. And the problem is, the slow part is probably not the thing that you think is slow. There's something else where the code works slightly different from what you think it works. And that is going to be the slow part. And since the code works slightly differently, it can easily be 100 times slower than anything else. I mentioned memory allocation or initializing a matrix inside a loop instead of outside. It could also be something like screen output or reading something from disk or writing something. It is usually something really stupid, and in the sense of completely unexpected. And if you change that, you can make codes 10 times faster. And the only way to find out is to measure. I mean, we're all physicists here. The only way to find out what really happens is to actually measure. And you can't have a guess, and you can have as many theories about your code. It doesn't work. It also doesn't work if you're an expert. I mean, you still need to profile if you're an expert. And other tips. What was it? Avoid fields with abstract containers and so on. It's a quite long section. Apparently, the Julia community takes performance quite seriously, which is good. Where were we? Okay. So we have about time for one more package, and I'll ask you what kind of package you want. there is a package called PyCall that's actually quite technical, that allows you to call arbitrary Python packages from Julia. So if there's your favorite Python package, NumPy or TensorFlow or PyPlot or something, what's it called? Matplotlib, you can just call it from Julia as well. There's a thing called Interact that allows you to have interactive presentations in Julia in a notebook. Actually, I started it yesterday. Maybe it's still running here. Where you have a slider, and if you change the slider, the number down here changes. You see that number here? And if you want to get the value, you get the current value out of the slider. That is in particular nice if it's a thing running in the background and some kind of graph, and then the graph plotting thing should change depending on how you interact something. I don't know, Mandelbrot Z and zooming in or something would be with the interact package. Then I could also show you something about HDF5. If you have large amounts of data, then there are kind of two communities for how you want to store the data. There is the community from unstructured data, from machine learning and so on, Excel spreadsheets. If you export an Excel spreadsheet so that it's readable by other packages, it usually comes in a format that is called CSV, which means comma-separated values. It's exactly what you think it is. It's a large two-dimensional table, and each line, their values are separated by commas, and then individual lines, and it looks exactly like an Excel spreadsheet, and you can read that from Julia and process it. Now, that's quite nice if some columns were missing, data are missing, and so on, but if you have structured data, if you want to read gigabytes or terabytes of data, you want something more efficient than comma-separated values. And then the standard format is HDF5. It's the hierarchical data format. And in an HDF5 file, you have like a little file system. You can have groups and files and data sets, arrays, put things in there and read them back out. And these files are portable. If you write something in binary and then write it on my laptop, you couldn't read it on a Raspberry Pi because they have different file formats, whereas HDF5 files can be read everywhere. And they're also good for archiving. There's a group that kind of looked at the HDF5 standard and then checked each individual bit of the file format, and they wrote their own tools to be able to read HDF5 files. So even if the HDF5 group went away 100 years from now, people could probably still read these HDF5 files. And it's kind of interesting. People took astronomical images 100 years ago, and then today we can still analyze the images because it might be photographic plates. But if you want to read one of these old tapes of satellite missions, it's quite difficult to read them because the hardware doesn't exist anymore. And your hope is that with the format that is HDF5, you can still read the respective files 100 years from now, even if we then use very different things. There are data structures. Sorry, here, what is this? I guess I'm not. Oh, data frames, if you're into data science. And what else? Collections. I missed it. Oh, here, this one. I apparently prepared way too much for this lecture. Functional collections. These are data structures such as dictionaries or queues or arrays, lookup tables, and so on. And functional means that once you create a data structure, they are immutable. You cannot change them anymore. And that has many advantages. In particular, if you have, say, a multi-threaded program, you cannot accidentally make a change from one part of the program and another part is then surprised. But of course, you still want to be able, once you have a table, to create a new table that is the old table with just a tiny modification. This is also possible. So there's a package for this, functional collections. They also call it persistent something, persistent list, persistent queue. Although I think persistent is was under is something else. For me, persistent is something that's like a database written to disk. So if your computer crashes, the data still persists. Okay. Very good. This was yeah, way faster than I intended it to be. It's also about time for me to stop the lecture that you can go to the colloquium. Do you have questions to any of these packages? Probably not. Then on Friday, we'll have the last Julia section where I tell you a bit about plotting, visualization, data analysis, and so on. And next week, it's then off to Louise Lehner and solving partial differential equations. See you Friday.